Welcome to episode 17 of the Serious About Security podcast for Tuesday, October 2nd, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group, Secure Purdue, and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or Sirius at Purdue University. Let me introduce the hosts of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at Sirius.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP.
So for announcements, October is the National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and here at Purdue we have a university-wide event on Friday, October 5th. And for you listening this week, it's this Friday. This event will include a keynote address by the Executive Director of Sirius, Dr. Spafford, followed by a presentation by Purdue's new Chief Information Security Officer, David Shaw. We will also have a panel discussion on the promise and peril of social networking that will include Dr. Spafford, David Shaw, Kyle Bowen, and Professor Lorraine Kesselberg. After lunch, there are two tracks, one on security awareness and the other on technical issues. Your podcast host today and many of the other Greater Lafayette security professionals are making a majority of the presentations. For more information, go to www.purdue.edu/securepurdue.
The next Sirius Security Seminar will be on October 3rd and will feature William Ink from North Carolina State University, and he will be speaking on defending users against smartphone apps, techniques, and future directions. On October 10th, Chris Knitch from the University of Illinois at Chicago will speak. Please join us in person at Stewart Center, room G52 at 4:30 p.m. or on Boiler TV, via podcast, or on YouTube. More information is available at the Sirius website, www.cerias.purdue.edu.
In news this podcast, Apple released a bunch of updates on September 19th. They updated Mac OS X to 10.7.5 and 10.8.2. They corrected a lot of security issues. They updated Safari to 6.0.1, correcting three issues. And they updated iOS to 6, which corrected a whopping 41 security issues, including several with Safari and the web browser on the iPhone and iPad. And Microsoft released an out-of-band update for Internet Explorer 6, 7, 8, and 9, which corrected a zero-day vulnerability on September 21st.
So for this podcast, we're going to take a little bit of a different tact. Occasionally, we do discussions on tools instead of issues in the news. And so for this podcast, we're going to talk about one-time password devices and their use as or their use in multi-factor authentication. So we've had a previous discussion before on password tools and talked a little bit about one-time passwords. And you can find more information about that in our episode number 4. And then previously, last year, we had a Greater Lafayette Security Professionals meeting in which I talked a little bit more about one-time password systems. And we still have slides available to that. And those links to those will both be in the podcast notes. So I encourage you to check those out. So to start us off, I thought I'd talk a little bit about hardware tokens and talk a little bit specifically about RSA keys. Now, the RSA company has been in the cryptography business for quite a while. And one of their devices that they sell is commonly known as a RSA secure ID, or it's commonly just called an RSA token, RSA key. And basically, it is a small device. And it has several form factors that is used to provide a secondary form of authentication when you access a service remotely. That could be through an interactive login, such as Telnet or SSH, or through a website, or specifically an application. And these tokens are designed to be fairly small, something that someone can easily carry with them. And they are designed to be fairly resistant to attack. And the software side on the server piece is designed to integrate with some existing authentication and directory solutions as well. And so these are really ideal in some environments in which you need to provide a device that is not tied specifically to a proprietary operating system, but still allows a user to use the token or the information provided on the device so that you can, as a user, get access to very sensitive data or to access a sensitive application. So some of the ideal things with these types of tokens are, as I mentioned, they're fairly resistant to attack. They're small and can be carried pretty much anywhere. They require that a user, in addition to reading the number displayed on the device, also needs to have either a PIN that is entered when they enter the device number, or the device itself may require a PIN in order to generate the correct number. Typically, we see they're small devices. They're kind of like in a key fob form factor and allows you to attach them to your keychain and just read the number off of them pretty easily. In previous versions, they used to be a credit card shaped device. It was slightly thicker than maybe two credit cards stacked together. They were a little more difficult because if you put them in your wallet and sat down on your wallet and crunched them, they didn't work too well after that. So they changed the form factor to be a little more durable and went with the keychain approach. And generally, you'll see not only RSA, but many other manufacturers have taken a similar tact with that. And so the way these things work is they have a secret. They have an algorithm that is used to take the secret and a current time and generate a six-digit number. And that number typically rotates every 30 to 60 seconds. So the current time and the secret are plugged into this algorithm, and typically these algorithms are proprietary. There's not too much public information about how these work exactly. That's considered trade secrets and probably patented information. These are a little more difficult to verify because we don't have access to the source code. We don't know how the algorithm works. We know that RSA has done their best to review the way the device works and fairly confident in that. But in terms of independent verification, I've not come across anything that kind of says, oh yeah, that way of doing it is the best way, or at least it's not a way that it has any known vulnerabilities to it. Unfortunately, RSA suffered a breach of their token information about this time last year, and that information may have been used by attackers to gain access to defense contractors that used RSA tokens. Now, it's a little iffy on this because some of the defense contractors and certainly RSA didn't release a lot of details about this, but RSA did come out and say that they would replace the tokens of customers that were affected by this issue. Since that time, we've not heard much more about it. We've not heard specifically about attacks against anybody else that has RSA tokens. So what exactly was stolen, how it was actually used, the details are a little fuzzy here, but it's certainly a concern. So one of the ways that these devices help protect the access to sensitive information is through a server side, a server component, which has the serial number and the secret associated with each device deployed in the field. Because if you lined up all the devices together, they each have a unique secret in them, and therefore the numbers displayed on them are all going to be different. So you couldn't attack somebody's account by stealing the coworker's secure ID device. That wouldn't actually help you. So each one has its own unique secret. They each have a clock inside, which is fairly accurate, but subject to some amount of drift. And the server side knows the user associated with each device, knows the secret associated in the device, and has a rough idea of how accurate the clock is based on the numbers that the user enters when they go to authenticate. And so they are able to handle some amount of that clock drift that can occur. Typically, when a user authenticates, they enter a four-digit PIN, or it can be larger, but typically four digits are what we see. And that's something that they select. And only the server knows what the PIN is once the user has registered the device. And if the device is found, they may know the number, they may know what user had it, but if they don't know the PIN, then they can't really access the account. The hardware tokens are fairly tamper-resistant, not completely tamper-resistant. The attacker would most likely want to extract the secret from the device and probably a good idea of what the time is on the device, although that's less important because that could be figured out through other means. But if they have the secret on the token, then they could clone their own. By cloning their own, they would have a device that generates the identical number sequence that the one under attack has. Knowing that, they would be able to more easily, not completely, but more easily attack an account. Again, they still have to have this PIN. So the device has a secret set at the factory when it's built, and it's tied in some way to its serial number. And that way you can enter the serial number on the back of the device, and there's a database somewhere that knows how to match up serial numbers to secrets. And then the secret, most likely when you try to physically tamper with the device, is going to get zeroed out, or at least it's going to be very difficult to extract. Not impossible, but very difficult. And so we find that RSA and many other companies that have built these types of security tokens have delivered roughly 250 million of these devices since they started making them. So that's a lot of devices out in the field. It's probably one of the more common security token devices available currently. So in the COAST lab at Purdue in the mid-90s, we used to use these RSA Secure ID cards, which were the credit card-shaped cards. And we use those to access remote Unix machines over Telnet. Now, keep in mind, at this time, we didn't have a lot of SSH, and typically that was still a fairly new service at the time. So typically we had pretty strong authentication, but we had very weak confidentiality because Telnet does not encrypt anything unless you're using it over Kerberos or some other service. But today we use, at Purdue at least, we have these things called boiler keys, which are really just RSA hardware tokens in their a key fob shape. These allow us to access at Purdue, sensitive information such as accounts, receivable, payable. The One Purdue portal system can be used for that. Can access the employees' payments for salary, that sort of thing. And so if you're at Purdue, you can actually get an RSA key to access Purdue systems for free. They don't charge your account to access these. And if you would like more information on how to get access to those here at Purdue, you can see the ITAP Secure Purdue page, I believe, has more information on how to get one. So the last thing I'll mention is that while the hardware tokens are nice to have, many people carry smartphones, and most of the manufacturers of hardware tokens also have software tokens that are basically software apps that run on your smartphone as well and pretty much emulate the same sort of system that the hardware tokens do. The issue with those is certainly that they run on less tamper-resistant devices. And so it's not clear yet how secure that software is, because the way it works can be more easily discovered through debugging techniques. So those are available, but I'm not sure if they are an improvement in security versus the hardware tokens. I'm kind of thinking that they are not. But, that kind of in a brief summary, kind of highlights some of these hardware token devices.
I have an interesting story related to RSA as well, Keith. As you were talking about them, I remember using it about 15 years ago. You were saying the credit card one, and I had that with my former employer. And I believe it was a 60-second turnaround time. And believe it or not, 15 years ago, I was connecting into these systems over dial-up. And I remember about the halfway point, I couldn't really try to use that number because through the dial-up connection, by the time it would negotiate, that number would expire. And then I would be denied access to the system and I'd have to start over again. So it's kind of funny, 15 years later, how much the technology shifted. I think these 30 to 60 second timeouts are much quicker, but just reminded me of, like you said, the wallet size ones, you had to be very careful with them. The little LED screen, very easy to break if you slammed your cup of coffee down on it or anything like that. So they have come a long way in recent years.
That is certainly true. And currently the tokens we have give you 30 seconds to enter that ID number. And so sometimes you have to wait until the countdown gets to the bottom and then starts over and generates a new number. And that's when the one you want to enter. But yeah, certainly the older ones were a little more sensitive to being dropped or kicked or sat on. So you had to be very careful with those.
Okay, well, I'm going to talk about another hardware token that kind of took a different route than RSA. They chose to kind of go the open route, where RSA is very, very secret about pretty much all of their internals. YubiKey is what I'm going to talk about, and they took the stance of being open, and they use an open protocol for doing their one-time passwords. And their server for authenticating is open, and they pretty much charge for support on their server and charge for the hardware tokens themselves, and I believe that's how they make money. But talking about the key itself, it's a USB device that acts as a USB keyboard. And you plug it into your computer, you hit a button on it, which is not really a button in the typical sense that it pushes down. It's kind of detects, kind of based on you put your finger on it and it puts in your one-time password. The keys themselves cost about $25 a piece, and if you buy a lot at the same time, they'll give you a discount on them, and they're constantly trying to innovate these keys. They currently have a key that has it's a contactless key. They have what they call a nano key, which basically fits in a USB port and is meant to stay in the USB port. This is if you want to basically tie it to a computer or some other device that has a USB port in it. And they have this new one that apparently can work with some mobile devices. I haven't really looked into it, but they're constantly trying to come up with new methods of using the YubiKey to make things secure. The one-time password algorithm it uses is called, they call it YubiKey one-time password. It was created by them, but I believe it was based off many of the standards. They use a method for generating one-time passwords that uses kind of an international standard of language, so that the keys that they use are available on all keyboards around the world, so that it's kind of international friendly. But it also supports other one-time password algorithms, such as Oath, HMAC one-time passwords. It also supports a challenge response mode, which is based off the YubiKey one-time password, or Oath HMAC, and it also supports static passwords. You can download a application for either, I believe, Mac or Linux or Windows to program these devices. They're write-only devices. You can't actually read any data off of them. You can't get your password or your key off of the device, but you can put a new key on it. Now, I'm saying that they're programmed at the factory with a key, just like the RSA keys that they have that YubiKey has on their servers, so you can authenticate with the YubiKey servers. But if you wanted to use these on an enterprise scale and support local authentication instead of authentication with them, if you don't want to trust them with your keys, you could get a server. I think it's called YubiRadius, and for free, and set up your own authentication system within your enterprise environment, and reprogram all your YubiKeys with new keys and new identities, and they even allow you to have a secondary secret identity and put a password on the keys so that people can't actually change their keys and things like that. You can do that all through the programming interface, and they support kind of mass programming where you insert a key in and it'll program it with a random key, put it in a database, and all that. It uses AES-128, it doesn't have a clock in it. It doesn't have a persistent clock or a battery in the device, so it doesn't support time-based one-time passwords, which I think there's a slight kind of security issue with the keys, that if somebody was generated a one-time password, didn't send it to authenticate, that password remains valid until they use the key at some point. They mention that on their website, and they say as long as somebody uses their keys on a frequent basis, then that problem doesn't exist. But the key, I could see a potential kind of man in the middle of attack if somebody was able to intercept your one-time password. It remains valid until it's used. The key is very, very tamper resistant. It's basically a wedge of plastic. They've on their site they've said they've been run through the washing machine and things like that, and they still continue to work. So they're very durable, very tamper resistant. They say that if you were able to get into them and read data off of them, you pretty much have destroyed the device. And as I said, you've got a UB Radius, which is the free authentication solution, which allows you to authenticate locally instead of via the UbiCo server. So you can use them in an enterprise environment and not, you know, you don't have to trust UbiCo. I think RSA might require you to trust them in order to use their keys, because they don't want to kind of give you the ability to kind of get rid of them. And I've used it for over 6 months. I don't remember when I got mine, but there's a few applications that I know support it. LastPass supports it. I think there's a PasswordSafe supports it. And if you install a helper app on your computer, it can do time-based one-time passwords as well. Since it doesn't have a clock in it, a persistent clock at least, it has a clock in order to do some randomness, but it only works when it's powered on. It doesn't keep track of the time. You need a helper app to do, like, Google authentication and things like that, or other one-time password time-based systems it can integrate with, but you can't just use the device itself. And that's the YubiKey.
So YubiKeys are kind of cool. I have one, but I don't really use it yet. But as you were talking, I kind of went through the YubiCo website, and I came across a document that talks about disk encryption and the YubiKey using TrueCrypt. So if you're using TrueCrypt to do a whole disk encryption strategy, there's some documentation on how to integrate that with the YubiKey, which I found to be very interesting. So some users may want to check that out. The other interesting thing is there are quite a few content management solutions and actually workstation logins that also take advantage of YubiKeys as well. So using things like WordPress, Drupal, Joomla, they all have modules that allow you to use YubiKey as an authentication tool. And then there's also some mention of a Windows-based tool called AuthLite, which has kind of a commercial corporation that actually provides something for Windows to do that. So you allow use your YubiKey to authenticate to Windows. And then there's some other tools out there. And I believe there's a PAM module or two that allow you to use it as well. So due to the openness of YubiCo and the YubiKey, we find that there are quite a few organizations and open source projects taking advantage of it, which is very cool, because that's something you won't find in contrast to RSA Secure ID. It's all proprietary software. And so since you don't know what the secrets are on the device and you don't know the algorithm used, there's no way you could you know, unless you figured out how to reverse engineer it, if you did that, it kind of violate the whole security value of that system. There's no way to really, you know, create open source equivalents in the RSA world, if you will, or any of the other manufacturers that have a similar sort of device like that. So I kind of like the YubiKey, and it compared to the RSA token, which has a number flashing at you, the YubiKey seems rather primitive, if you will. But given its capabilities and the fact that you can use the personalization tool to actually go and write your own key into the device or overwrite the existing information on the device, it's very cool and it's very flexible. So I hope to take the YubiKey that I have and start using it a little more than I do today. But yes, it's very cool.
Well, let me just say, on top of that, I have written authentication module for YubiKey, and it is very, very easy to write stuff. And they have on there, they have, since it is kind of an open system, they have things for pretty much any language that you could possibly think of. They even have, as you said, PAM, and they have you can do Apache basic authentication using a YubiKey. They have Perl, Python, Ruby, C, C Sharp, PHP, Java, Lisp, and they support, I think, WordPress, Drupal, and even SAP. So there's a lot of interfaces there that you can associate a YubiKey with.
Well, the final tool we're going to discuss today is the Google Authenticator. And unlike the YubiKey and RSA that we've already discussed, this is not a hard piece of hardware that you purchase. This is a mobile application that will allow you to enable two-step verification on your smart device, your smartphones or your iPod touches, your iPads. It is developed with open source standards, and it's like I said, is freely available. And the Google Authenticator project includes implementations of the one-time passcode generators, supporting PAM. It also supports one-time passcodes for the Initiative for Open Authentication, OAuth, which is not related to the OATH, OATH, which is not related to OAuth. Those two terms get tangled up quite a bit, and I actually just did that now, but it's actually completely separate. It is OATH, OATH. And these implementations support the HMAC-based one-time password algorithm and also support the time-based one-time password. In the case of the time-based one-time password, you will receive a code that changes every 30 seconds. So to set this up on Google, you actually can enable the two-step verification. When you do that, you'll be when you set up this app, you'll be presented with information that you'll need to plug in, or you can actually, which is kind of cool, you can actually get a QR code that you can scan into your device using your camera to scan it, and it'll configure it for you kind of automatically. And once you have that set up, you'll then get these six-digit codes that change every 30 seconds. One of the things when you're setting it up with inside Google is that this works really well when you're logging into Google's website. For the other things that you might use Google for example, you know, Gmail, where you have you might have an Outlook client or a Thunderbird client, Google allows you to set up application-specific passwords, basically unique one-time passwords for those services, and then you can manage all that through your main Google profile. I'm actually logged in looking at mine, and I can see all the separate application-specific passwords I have and what devices I have those for, and right next to all those, you know, there's a creation date, there's a last use date, then there's this nice little revoke button where at any time I can say I want to revoke that. So, you know, if I lose that device, I can revoke the certificate, and then whoever gets a hold of that device can't use it to log in.
You might also point out that once you create an application-specific password and enter it into your software device, and then you click the continue button, you can no longer see it. So if somebody got access to your account, they could look at your application-specific password list, but they wouldn't see the password. They'd only see the name you assigned to it and the revoke button.
So once it's once that application password is used, it's not visible again.
Yes. It's not. There's no way for me to pull back that application specific password. And furthermore, when I first set this up, what was interesting to learn was, I use Outlook both on a a workstation and a laptop, and I got that application specific password, and I thought I could just kind of plug it into both, and it did not like that. It wanted specific for the device, so I actually had to go create a different one for the laptop versus the one I used on the PC. So it was very nice, but as Keith mentioned, once you use it, you can't ever retrieve it again. You can't see it. And if you need to set up another device, it's very easy. They have a little thing where you can just generate it directly on their site. So I got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but that's just one of the side effects, I guess. If you enable two-factor authentication using your Google account and use Google services for other things, those are ways around it. It's not that every time you go into your email, you have to put in your ID, password, and then type in the 6-digit code. But it is very nice. It adds that extra layer of security. The Google Authenticator is officially supported on Android version 2.1 or later, BlackBerry OS 4.5 to 6.0, and the iPhone and iPod iOS versions 3.1.3 or later. There are some third-party implementations that also support the Windows phones. But those aren't provided directly by Google, but by third party. There are a couple popular sites using it, LastPass and Dropbox. There's also, I believe, plugins available for WordPress and Drupal. However, it was hard to find a definitive list of sites that support this because they're using the open standards. Any site that implements those open standards, you'll be able to use the Google Authenticator within those sites. Furthermore, if you access another site using your Google, if you choose to log into a separate site and it gives you the option to log in using your Google credentials, if you use your Google credentials, then it will support the Google Authenticator, and you'll have that two-step verification enabled for that as well. So some of the advantages for the Google Authenticator is that it's open source and it's free, and it uses a piece of hardware that you have that you should always keep with you, your phone or your tablet, something you're heavily invested in keeping, trying not to lose. The downside as well is it is your own hardware, and phones are easy targets, and if a phone sitting down on a table is probably more likely to be picked up than maybe a small USB key sitting there, or maybe someone would take both.
Which also brings up the issue of you should have a pin or some sort of pattern to lock your phone, because if somebody fires up your Google Authenticator app, they certainly have access to that. Now, assuming they have other information too that helps them, but you gotta protect the device. Sure.
Absolutely. Additionally, you'd want to have there's many good reasons to lock your smartphone screen, and this is just one other reason. And we'll actually provide additional examples of that on our presentation on Friday. That's one of the items we'll discuss, is locking your phone. So, but yes, there's many good reasons, and especially with an app like this, you do want to kind of keep it protected. The one thing, there is that 30-second window where that code is valid. So it has to show you the code. So when you bring it up on your phone, it is visible. Somebody walking by could see it, but that code is only good for that 30-second window. Furthermore, because it's two-factor authentication, they already have to know your username and password in order to really be able to take advantage of that 6-digit code. So it is pretty easy to establish and get set up with your Google account. I do recommend it. The only downside is, when you're logging into your device, maybe you're at home and you're in one room and your phone's in the other, and you go, oh, where's my phone? I got to go get the Google Authenticator. Oh, I got to put in my PIN or my password on the lock screen. Oh, okay, now here's the code. Oh, it just changed. Now I need to put in the new code or whatever. But it's not really too bad.
Yeah, there's some amount of hassle involved, but I look at the downsides. If somebody were to gain access to my account what damage could they wreak on me? And it would be pretty significant. So having an extra layer of defense works in your favor. And I think this, certainly Google Authenticator and YubiKey, and in some situations, if you have an RSA key, those, that's what it does. It kind of raises the bar for the attacker. Certainly there are known attacks for each of these devices. But raising the bar a bit limits what damage can result in some respects. So they're more likely to go after somebody else who maybe is a little more easy target. So let's be a strong target and use these one-time password devices.
Well, one thing I had a comment about was with the Google Authenticator and it, basically anything that is a software-based solution, is the key has to be stored somewhere on a device, and I don't know how it gets stored. It needs it in order to do this encryption and produce the code, so I'm wondering how easy it is to get this key off the software device.
It is easy to do that. It may not be stored, you know, and it may be XORed with some static information, but it's still stored somewhere. And the fact that you can run a debugger on your Android device means most likely you could figure it out. So that's why some of these issues, like we talked about with software-based RSA tokens and some of the other manufacturers that make similar tokens have a software equivalent that runs on a smartphone, those don't seem as safe to me because, yes, you can most likely extract that secret key somehow. And that kind of defeats the purpose of that. Now, maybe this is, you know, if we're looking at an enterprise solution, which is certainly what the RSA thing is, and many of the other types of hardware tokens, there's a significant investment in that. And so most likely those are going to be enterprise environments. They may have additional policies and procedures. They may not supply the device to the employee. That might be something that's, you know, paid for through corporate funds, that sort of thing. And so they have additional software to help protect the device. But still, there's a little bit of risk there associated with that.
Yeah, and I think the security of these devices is really, when you look at the scope, though. One, to get the key, it may not be difficult to get off the device, but how difficult is it to get into that device or to get a hold of that device? This is where I would make the argument that, in my case, I feel like Google Authenticator is a really great choice because I'm very protective of this phone. I spent a lot of money. This phone cost me. I've got a lot of good data on it. I keep it with me all the time. I do have YubiKey. I don't currently have an RSA key fob, but I do have a YubiKey, and I kind of keep it off to the sidelines. I mean, and it's like, am I always aware of where it's at? Sometimes I'm not, but you know, based on how I'm using it too, I don't really need it that often. Whereas the phone I need constantly, I have it with me constantly. So I think that's one of the advantages in having it run on these smart devices. You know, a smartphone is, users are invested now. If the user's not being careful with their smartphone, that's just it. There's a lot of dangers with a smart device if you're not being careful with it, beyond just Google Authenticator. If I don't have a passcode lock and I'm leaving my phone laying around and I've got a lot of sensitive information on it, I have my email running, and it requires no additional authentication, someone can pick that up and they can just do a lot of bad things to the phone. But if I'm security conscious with my phone, I don't really see it as any greater risk. That they'll be able to get to that key because there's going to be, you know, it's going to have a passcode lock. It's going to wipe the device after so many failed attempts. I mean, the device is set to self-destruct, if you will. So I think, in that scheme, it's all on how you secure it. I think, yes, a smartphone can be very insecure, but there's things you can do to secure it. And then I think you're getting the equal amount of effective security out of that.
And as I mentioned, the RSA tokens and any other hardware tokens, very proprietary. And I'm looking at, you know, just a little search to see what's available out there. And if you want to buy a pack of 50 of the security or the RSA Secure ID SID 700 token, a pack of 50 of them at the lowest price I can find online is $2,500. That's a significant amount. I mean, it's about $50 a key. Now, that doesn't even count the licensing for the software which I believe is a yearly cost. So certainly RSA, Secure IDs, much more costly solution, but perhaps more, certainly more, you know, for the enterprise environments, maybe even for an application-specific type use. And there may be some advantages to doing that, given the security of the token itself. If you're looking at, you know, like small, medium-sized business, then YubiKey becomes a more attractive option, mostly because of the openness. And the other advantage, you can buy a single YubiKey if you want. You don't have to buy a huge quantity of these things. If you wanted to buy a single YubiKey and use it to secure your access to your blog through WordPress using a plugin to WordPress, you can do that. And that's great. And I don't do that currently, but I'm thinking that I should be doing that soon. So, you know, that's a project for me to look at. So, but I can afford to do that because I already have the token. I only paid $20 for it. And I've got, I didn't have to invest in an RSA solution for that one site that I want to protect, right? So if you're looking for, you know, small projects, scale, and you want to have some sort of one-time password solution, certainly Google Authenticator or YubiKey looks more attractive to do that.
Well, the other thing about YubiKey as opposed to RSA is YubiKey kind of has created a method where you don't actually have to trust them at all. I mean, just basically the little device you get, that's your level of trust that the device is secure, but they provide an authentication server that you can use. They provide everything that you need to basically take them out of the equation when it comes to having your keys, your private keys, and so if you don't like, you have to trust RSA. You have to trust that what they're doing is secure. And obviously there was a breach recently on them, and some security was compromised due to them holding essentially your keys, where you can essentially take responsibility for your own security and take them out of the equation if you want. You don't have to, but you have the option. And with that, we'll wrap it up. I just wanted to thank the hosts of the podcast, Mike Hill and Keith Watson, and thanks to Secure Purdue and Sirius. Have a safe and secure day.